Laying used to take, you know, anywhere from 6 months to a year to sell. So it's, I mean, I think that if you're going to sell it, especially.
Well, hey, welcome. This is Dave. I hope everybody's doing great. I want to see if there are questions or clarifications from the first seminar, and I want to also check who has done some of the exercises or work tools to have some experience to report about the usefulness to you. Anyone done any of those and have anything to comment on in terms of the usefulness to you or potentially for your clients? One at a time now. I think what you'll find useful, my prediction is that you will find most useful the neuroconditioning chart that we went over in terms of helping a client sort of deconstruct an emotional trigger and look at a systematic, simple way to have an alternative instead of getting stuck in the content, trying to figure out the content or work on the content, but to address instead the process of the state change and how the emotional trigger created a state change, and look at it at that level. And the exercise that I mentioned in talking about my client of recommending that she set aside at least 30 minutes, maybe 40 or 45 minutes, to write down all the emotional triggers that she was aware of for a specific circumstance, and the immediate recognition of what her change of state was, what behavior and her thoughts that introduced, to at least cue her radar for an awareness of that in order to approach it in a different way, to have from a later session that you have with yourself a way of developing a mantra to instantly get grounded and centered and have an ideal behavior to move into. This is a fundamental, proven systematic way to regulate states of mind and manage emotions. That, I believe, is the most challenging aspect of success for anyone. Anybody have any experiences with that or thoughts about it or questions about it? Well, I'll open it up for other thoughts, questions, any comments you want to make or any clarifications or questions you have that came from our discussion last time. Or I'll move into the presentation, but I'm really interested in any comments or usefulness or discussion or application that you've tried. Have any of you had further thoughts about this or even considered applying it or looked at the exercises at the back of the outline to look at perhaps trying some of the exercises out that might fit a specific aspect of what you're dealing with? There's a very brief mindfulness meditation exercise. There are a number of things that might be helpful if you think about applying them. Anything then before we go into our material then? Well,
hi, Dr.
Yes, please go ahead.
I'm sorry. Hi, Dr. Kruger. This is Catherine. Hi, how are you?
Good. I'll talk to you if you'll call me Dave.
All right, I'll call you Dave.
Okay, great. Go
ahead. I didn't use the chart with a client that I'm working with. Part of it is building confidence. He's in school and he's taking a nursing program. He's a little bit older. He's younger than I am, but a little bit older, and he's in this nursing program with a lot of younger students. And so sometimes, you know, he has a kind of an ebb and a flow of, should I be doing this? Should I not be doing this? It's my passion, but, you know, why am I here kind of thing. So I did go through breathing, using a breathing exercise, and he actually came up with a mantra himself, you know, and I said, well, that's great, you know, that key word that will trigger the calming so that he can focus, because that's really what we were looking at with focusing.
Yes.
And so that was good. I will use that chart with him. It just wasn't the time or place. At my last session with him.
It sounds
like
you're addressing some fundamental things about confidence being a state of mind, and
right.
that he can best access a confident state by being really grounded and centered and using a mantra to do that. Because, when we're grounded and centered, we have access to all of the information in all of our states of mind, and if we're off even a little bit, have a little bit of an altered state, a little bit of an anxious or just simply a focus somewhere else, it will limit the access to everything we know. And it sounds like him, especially maybe for test taking or performing on orals, it would be important, the most important immediate preparation that he can do is to get very grounded and centered and get in the flow of an optimum performance.
Exactly. You said that so much better than I did. But exactly. Exactly. I do have a question about some of the reading. The reading for this week was excellent based on that, the confidence level. Do you want me to wait until you're through going through?
Are you referring to the outline?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's the outline of what I'm going to be discussing. And I didn't really think about it as a reading, but if it was helpful, good. But it's important things that I'm going to be talking about are in the outline, so you don't have to take notes and that sort of thing, so you can just kind of listen and absorb it and integrate it.
Right. I will have, as I read through the outline, because I did read, read it, but I have a question, but I'll wait until the end of it.
Tell me the question,
you
and
might...
I'll see if we're going to cover it, or I'll work it into the discussion, because we're going to start by talking about confidence. So
okay. Well, this was... All right, this is actually in on page 4, the pre-commitment and preparation for confidence, and it states cultivate mental imagery of a future memory of success to live into, but then under performance expertise and deliberate practice, it says practice itself can make you worse. So in my mind, in my state of mind, a kind of conflict, and I'm sure you'll cover that. So, but it, to me, it kind of conflicts a little bit.
Okay. All right. I will talk about that because I'm really referring to that. If you practice in a compromised way, it can grow a bad habit, because what we repeat, we etch in our brain. When we repeat it enough, it becomes a default mode. So if you practice in a compromised way, it will create a bad habit. Even if you practice, when you have a slight injury, you favor one leg or one knee, you practice a long time in that, it will compromise your ultimate performance because you've grooved a habit that's based on less than 100%.
Okay.
Keep that in mind, and then let's see if what I say will clarify, or if not, we'll come back and address it again, because that's a good question.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for that, Catherine. Anyone else, any other things to highlight or talk about or ask before we move into the material? Okay, well, I'm going to put us on lecture mode. Okay, we're going to talk about the neuroscience of peak performance, and first began with talking about confidence. Olympic gold medalist Nuredine Moricelli of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" Dr. Denton Cooley, a medical colleague in Houston, offered his version. When you're asked to name the top three surgeons in the world, you should have trouble thinking of the other two. Now, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but still an example. Neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. I have a blog called Confidence is a State of Mind. It's archived in my blog section at MentorPath that you may want to look at. Elaborates a little bit more and in a different direction than I'm going to be talking about right now. Confidence is both art and neuroscience, and it initiates access to the mindset containing the necessary skills established by deliberate practice. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essays and provided written feedback. The researchers divided the essays randomly into two piles. On one, they added a generic note in the teacher's handwriting saying, "I'm giving you these comments so you'll have feedback on your paper." The essays in the second pile received a note saying, "I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and I know you can reach them." When those students who received the generic note, 40% revised their papers. For the students who received the encouraging high expectation notes, almost 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections as the first group. Confidence, like any state of mind, is contagious. It's a midbrain to midbrain transmission as a state of mind. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have a certainty, your brain will find a way. And this is important, especially to mentor coaches. What we now know from neuroscience, belief in someone transforms a state of mind in the recipient to a more creative, integrative state. The most important thing then that we can do with our client and for our client is to believe in that client. And then the client will teach us both why. Success most often has to do with two things: the state of mind of confidence that we engage in endeavor, and how we manage an optimum performance state under pressure-inducing circumstances. Confidence is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through your actions. It's initially subjective. It's an emotional regard of a promise that you live into then to make it a reality. Confidence is an internal sense that I can make this work. Optimism is the belief everything's going to work out. Confidence projects competence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. So now let's apply the neuroconditioning chart from last seminar to create an optimum state of confidence. Rather than starting with a negative emotional trigger, start with a positive one. Here's an example of that. My daughter wanted me to run a portion of the Boston Marathon with her from the days since she was in college there. She wanted me to join her at Boston College and for us to run the last several miles to the finish line together. She learned how hard it was to qualify for the marathon with both sponsorship and times. It was much later, after she got her doctorate and moved back to Boston to practice, it became a reality when she finally qualified and obtained sponsorship. For me, excited and horrified sort of blended. While I'm a lifetime athlete, distance running is absolutely not my thing. Running has always been in relation to some ball. I knew I'd have to develop some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and even pain of training to cross the finish line together. Now, one of my favorite sayings is, "Fate whispered to the warrior, you cannot withstand the storm." The warrior whispered back, "I am the storm." Each time in training, when I would have otherwise maybe quit early or rationalized about stopping because of pain, that mantra, that saying that represented my mantra, I am the storm, sustained my effort. Many I am the storms later, we cross the finish line shoulder to shoulder. Now, let's look at how this works. The brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the neurochemical messenger that helps us remain calm and make rational decisions. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain, for rational thought and decision making. In brain chemistry, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. With psychological threat and anxiety, the challenge is to regulate state of mind to maintain serotonin and sustain confidence. Another transmitter that directly affects confidence is oxytocin. This chemical transmitter that mediates bonding and connection fosters an internal mindset of confidence. This connection can be important for important others or to an internal ideal. So, neuroscience research shows that the first words spoken in a conversation trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener to boot up a specific mindset. This is conversational intelligence. That mindset then processes the remainder of the conversation to determine meaning and significance. So this is huge for any leader, from business to sports to parenting to mentor coaching. A conversation that begins with remarks that are perceived as authoritative, critical, adversarial, activates the brain's defensive circuitry of fight, flight, or freeze, mediated by stress chemicals, cortisol and adrenaline. The listener then experiences some degree of guardedness, anxiety, or distrust, and may close down somewhat for self-protection. The subsequent conversation is then viewed from that mindset. Now, on the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system related to bonding and connection. This initial perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion induces a desire to listen without judgment, to pay full attention to the speaker, and frames the remainder of the conversation. The listener feels safe, heard, and understood, connected. Trust develops with openness to further collaboration to optimize performance and results. Now, how this relates to confidence. Building confidence requires, even demands, hard work, risk, persistence, even tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites, but the result of effective engagement. In other words, if you're waiting to feel comfortable or waiting to feel confident, it won't happen in that way. You have to establish a mindset of confidence and do it. Then you'll get comfortable. So, how can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? First, here's how not to do it. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, a coach has probably ensured that it will happen again. This is from Alexander Wolf in Sports Illustrated. This is also why Catherine, your client, we need to talk about his negative self-talk, because this can do the same thing. We're going to address self-talk in a bit, but that's also very, very important. A common perception is that the best way to get employees or players to perform is by pointing out mistakes, threats, or even just being intense. While negative emotions grab attention, a positive focus works considerably better to develop confidence as a mindset, and the associated aspects of loyalty, bonding, personal development, and commitment to a group. Priming of mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. Here are 7 strategies. These are in your outline for successful priming for confidence. To have a mantra for grounding and centering. This is first. Remember, state always comes first before strategy and story. So get grounded and centered. Ask yourself positive, powerful questions to induce serotonin. Recall a time of successful accomplishment of a similar challenge. Identify moments of significant confidence, a feeling of I can do it, or whatever it takes. Focus on connections with important others to activate oxytocin response. Create mental imagery of success to live into, perhaps even a visualization specifically of success. And consider cultivating a circle of supportive people and especially a mentor. Now, think about this as a component. For those of you who have played the game Taboo, you know you have a target word on a card that you've drawn that you want your partner to say your given word, and you're able to give single word clues without gestures. Also on that card, below the target word are a half dozen words that you can't use, words that would make it too easy. Think about how hard it is once you've seen those 6 words not to say one of those 6 words, because your focus has already been anchored. If you say one of those 6 taboo words, you lose the point. Often what you should not say can frame and dominate thinking to make it hard to get beyond the taboo words to offer reasonable clues. People have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of the past forward. Appreciative inquiry, and this is something that we basically do in coaching all the time. I'm just adding a concept here because it's a whole discipline and study that can tell us something. Appreciative inquiry looks at how a person or organization can study and define the best that there is, and then use the information to build on what's already working. Think about when you ask a coaching client, you know, have you done anything like this in the past that you've been successful at? Dr. Diana Whitney, the founder of Appreciative Inquiry, was a guest on my mastermind group, so I have a real appreciation. She described systematic studies of appreciative inquiry that showed 3 important aspects. 1, focus on what works to enhance what works. Ask about what you want more of rather than problems and barriers. You get what you focus on. If you focus on the taboo words, it's hard to get beyond them. Secondly, focus becomes a reality. A focus on possibility elicits a positive mindset. Focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. This is a blending of conversational intelligence and appreciative inquiry. And thirdly, appreciative inquiry awakens possibility, an aha experience. Looking at possibility creates new neuronal networks and pathways in the brain instead of going down the one that's already there to look at a problem. A head coach, a head athletic coach, who attempted to lead his team to victory, told them, I know what it takes to win games. I know how to condition the players to map game strategy. I lead the team by letting each player know what I expect of them and exactly what to do. Unfortunately, this didn't work. The result was that the team was not even close to peak performance and winning results. The coach could not understand why his players were not taking his directives. He had outstanding athletes on his team, but they didn't feel valued or respected, but instead felt judged and criticized. Remember, the first few words of a discussion will boot up a mindset that processes the entire remainder of the mindset. So let's apply this now to mindfulness training and peak practice. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won 6 NBA championships. Then, as coach of the Los Angeles Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation to his team. They won 5 NBA championships, most of anyone in history. In a study in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, researchers at the University of Miami found that expert athletes who practiced mindfulness for 12 to 15 minutes a day were more able to sustain emotional and mental demands of physical training, had greater resilience, and more sustained focus. The essential simplicity of meditation is to focus on one thing, such as your breath, and give full attention to that focus. When your mind wanders, which it will, notice that it's wandered and move back to your point of focus on your breathing. When your mind wanders, refocus again. Keep doing this and your focus and attention will become easier. Being aware of this process is a way of being aware of awareness. This selective attention aligns the energy field of your brain. Let's do a brief mindfulness meditation right now. This is in your outline, and I'm going to ask you to close your eyes to get in a very comfortable, seated, upright position. Close your eyes and focus only on your breathing, the flow of air in and out of your nose. As you focus just on your breath, relax your body. Attend only to your breathing, following its movement in and out of your body. When your mind wanders, refocus on your breath. Feel your whole body move and relax with your breath as you breathe in relaxation and out tension. If you have a thought, watch it come and go without engaging. Continue breathing as your center of focus. Anchor this state right now with a cue of a simple gesture or phrase. It may be simply touching your chest or your forehead, putting your thumb and finger together. Something that will cue this state so you can more quickly enter it next time. Finally, release your focus on breathing and simply sit, being aware of your relaxed state, of your body, and the experience of unfocus. Pause for a moment to gradually re-enter usual awareness. When you do this brief mindfulness meditation, consider ending the meditation with a specific gratitude, something you're grateful for in present time, as you're aware of the relaxed state of your muscles and the steadiness of your heartbeat. Open your eyes and gradually come back to focus on present awareness. In a number of studies, a focus on gratitude itself boosts energy levels, enhances resilience, and increases beneficial hormones in the body. This mindfulness training can be a specific, deliberate practice component for optimum performance. Phil Jackson can attest to that. physiological changes in the brain with these practices have been shown to generate faster learning, decrease stress, and enhance performance. Okay, consider this question. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving much at things that matter to you despite spending a lot of time working on them? And I'm talking about everything from physical to intellectual, but pick something to answer that question. The prevailing theory for decades held that experience was the key to expertise. The more someone practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise. Number of studies came to that conclusion. Yet, compelling research shows that we don't gain experience from experience alone. Dr. Anders Ericsson has spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they become experts. He has studied the art and science of how someone practices to become experts and what they do to perform exceptionally. Deliberate practice. Now, here's a zinger. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau. This is usually a result of movement away from time in the learning zone to focus more time on performing. For example, older and more experienced physicians paradoxically can perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. The reason for this documented finding is initially not obvious. While the younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school, continuing education of the experienced physicians should bridge that gap, and the gap should be further widened by the years of experience in the trenches. But this is usually not the case. What's missing, we know now, is deliberate practice. A conclusion reached by Ericsson and colleagues is that with few exceptions, people don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience does not make an expert. How someone practices informs how someone performs. The vast majority of learning and growing occurs during practice, not during performance. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal with openness for input from a mentor provides significantly more effective results than massive repetition or regular practice. With artists, intellectuals, and athletes, consistent findings by Ericsson's team was that neither experience nor practice was the crucial variable. Deliberate practice was. Expertise is not about the total number of hours of practice, as in the 10,000-hour rule, but the type of practice that fills those hours makes the crucial difference. For example, Ericsson and his team found that the number of years of practice had no correlation with how successful a clinical psychologist was with his or her patients. He found that in a number of instances, significant expertise, such as physics professors and practicing physicians, did not do as well as newcomers in their respective areas. Repetition of the same experiences is different from deliberate practice focusing on improving. In fact, as I mentioned in the discussion, practice can make you worse. Every shot that misses its mark is making your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. The creation of muscle memory is a process of myelination, of rewiring your brain. Repetition of specific intended motor skills rewires so that each time, over and over, it becomes faster, easier, smoother. The drawback is a skill performed in the wrong way can become hardwired. So the solution is not to try harder or more, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher or a coach, someone who's familiar with the obstacles and can suggest ways to overcome them. Here are four simple steps to change a behavior. Identify the goals, determine the mindset and behaviors to optimally achieve them, develop an action plan, and then program new identity to incorporate the changes. Here are the biggest two challenges for changing any behavior, and each of you know this in working with clients. The mind's inclination to create certainty by repetition of the known outcome. This is a bias to want immediate closure and predictability, even if it's not cause and effect, even if it's not the result you want. You just want it over with. Secondly, the brain has rewired repeated behavior and has an error detection mechanism that alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. So you try something new, even if it's better, it's going to read as, this isn't right. It's going to read as discomfort. So let's talk now about specifically the learning zone and the performance zone. The characteristics of elite performers in business, sports, various endeavors are all similar and all start with mindset. And we have in this regard two distinct mindsets, a learning zone and a performance zone. In a learning zone, the goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master, expect to make mistakes, but to learn from them. Deliberate practice occurs in the learning zone rather than the performance zone. And in the performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible, to execute what's been practiced, and not think about how to do it better, but to do what you practiced, to get in that zone. The learning zone maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance. That's where flow happens. Research on the deliberate practice mindset shows that anyone can improve with the right approach. If you're not improving, it doesn't mean you lack basic talent, but it may be because you're not practicing in the right way. So here's the conclusion from a massive amount of brilliant research on deliberate practice. There are five specific activities in the learning zone of deliberate practice. Focus on a specific skill to improve on. Specify the specific goal, not just getting better. Determine a challenge that is just beyond your comfort zone. Use feedback with repetition and adjustments on execution. And finally, engage the guidance of a skill coach or mentor to correct mistakes and introduce new possibilities. Practice does not make perfect. Practice makes permanent. Practice of a slightly incorrect skill sequence will result in permanent etching of that incorrect sequence. The right kind of practice, carried out over a sufficient period of time, leads to improvement. Deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predefined talent or ability. A bunch of research on that. Only deliberate practice with expert information and mentoring will result in enhancing expertise and developing skill. Deliberate practice modifies the structure and function of the brain, increasing the ability to perform skillfully. Deliberate practice always pushes a comfort zone, employs a growth mindset to go beyond the comfortable repetition just beyond current ability. Improvement always resides just beyond a comfort zone. It requires full engagement to the attention of conscious actions. So here are just a brief overview, seven framework principles to develop significant skills with deliberate practice. And this is cognitive skills as well as physical skills. Choose an activity you deeply want to improve. Establish a fixed time for practice, a structure. Limit practice sessions to perhaps an hour at a time to maintain intense focus. Establish concrete, specific signs for improvement. What gets measured gets improved. Connect with like-minded people who believe in what you're doing. Align what you do with your ideals, your core values. core values. And lastly, establish SMART goals. You guys are very familiar with this. Specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, time-bound. Let me give you an example in a somewhat different sort of way. The New York Times multiple bestseller, Janine Roth, whose work I admired, was an expert content contributor in my mastermind group. In response to one of the questions about writing her books, Janine revealed that she never lets any writing be seen by anyone until she's done at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, focuses. As part of this process, she gets feedback from savvy readers. So, deliberate practice and mental representations I want to talk about for just a moment. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized these characteristics: self-awareness. Self-awareness is the foundation of deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires this ability to be attuned to all levels of self and performance and to incorporate the flexibility of taking in new information in order to change. Self-awareness is a particular systems understanding of the self to look both subjectively and objectively at patterns of emotion, behavior, attachment, including communication with others. The ability to see oneself, recognize patterns, and think systemically are important aspects of understanding one's own dynamics and the dynamics of others. A component of deliberate practice is developing a corresponding mental representation of the specific process and structure of outstanding performance. Mental representations allow you to see meaningful patterns and to live into them. Deliberate practice develops mental representations that enhance and perfect performance and form the foundation of revising an internal model that incorporates the change to make it permanent. So, 5 questions to ask for each performance goal you set. Is your goal specific? Is your goal measurable? Is it positive? Is it inspiring to you? And is your goal displayed? Is it evident? Have you put it in view somewhere? Written it down. Erickson emphasized that the central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize the execution of skills. That's what deliberate practice does, is to develop those mental representations along with motor memory. And deliberate practice is designed to make these representations improve over time. In various studies, when people are first provided a context of overview and meaning, they can remember about twice as much subsequent information as when they're not provided this framework of meaning. With a context of meaning, the encoding of memories has a framework to make it make sense. Providing that meaning after the experience doesn't help memory or memory retrieval because there wasn't a framework used to encode it. Connections and new information within an existing network make integration and learning way easier. So let's look for just a bit at peak experience and peak performance. Do you remember a specific moment in a performance you did or an outstanding play you executed? Peak experiences are personal moments of lasting positive affect, an exciting and fulfilling high point of an instance that's unusually intense and meaningful. These flashbulb moments of personal high points of exciting and fulfilling experience serve as an example moment, a positive representation and highlight of an entire set of experiences. These instances can serve as an organizer and motivator for other performance-based activities. Peak experiences, like peak performance, are most likely to occur in a state of flow, a sustained state of mind that allows access to the execution of a skill developed by deliberate practice. And flow, as you know, is described as being in the zone, an ideal mental state to execute an activity that allows full access to the developed skill as well as the experience of enjoyment. Flow is characterized by a total immersion in the activity, relying on the default performance activity without conscious direction or thought. In fact, and we'll talk about this more in a subsequent seminar, even a nanosecond of moving to an observer's position or thinking about the performance itself can create a derailment of that automatic flow pattern, that zone. Implicit learning is unconscious. While the learning, practice, and acquisition component are focused and conscious, the memory and patterns of execution are system one and unconscious. The right kind of conscious framework and focus is required to access and execute this unconscious memory. And what that means simply is elite performers in any kind of endeavor have trained to be able to make the right decision at the right time without thinking about it. For example, a soccer goalie intercepts an incoming shot in a nanosecond of response. A race car driver accelerates precisely at the instant of a cornering turn. I've worked with two race car drivers who describe this experience but have difficulty in deconstructing the elements of exactly how they do it. The link between perception and action, the time between seeing and doing, is instantaneous, precisely formed. I've also seen the fastest land animal, a cheetah in Africa, running at an amazing speed, be able to instantaneously shift course in order to avoid an obstacle as well as pursue a prey. The unconscious pattern development is installed by deliberate practice and sustained by being in the flow. I want to talk about another element. I'll call it the last shot. When I was playing basketball with my son and daughter in the driveway, we would never end on a miss. They had to make the last basket they shot before we stopped. Later, when I coached their basketball teams, each player had to make the last basket he or she shot before we ended practice. Somehow, I knew intuitively this made a difference, that endings made a difference. Even brief, seemingly meaningless endings of our driveway basketball or our Tuesday night team practices before the big game on Saturday. Later, I would learn of Dr. Daniel Kahneman's research on peak experience, that the two times of the most impactful experiences and subsequent powerful memory are the moment of greatest impact and the ending. My son, 2 years older than my daughter, taught me about the importance also of a performance state of mind. With his being the first team I ever coached at his age 8, we would get together as a group at our home gym the day of the game, shoot briefly, and go over the few rudimentary plays we had. The team would then all pile into my car. Now, remember, this was the era before mandatory seatbelts. And drive to the gym, we would play listening to Eye of the Tiger. This was their request. It was a raucous repetition of the song in which they would all sing along at high volume, got everybody into the spirit before the game. And they did absolutely exceptional with this prep. Now, 2 years later, I began coaching my daughter's all-girl basketball team when she reached age 8. And we began practice in the same way with a little inspirational talk, teamwork, moving directly into basics, and then scrimmage. It didn't work. They were distracted and didn't seem to respond, as if they were there for something besides basketball. I was actually baffled. As I listened to them and observed more closely, I began to sense what I'd missed. Basketball was the content of the practice, but their state of mind focused on the process of being together, of playing together. While I was urging them to concentrate on being competitive, they just wanted to enjoy themselves and each other. Soon enough, we began practice sitting in a circle on the court, just talking. That was their warm-up. And strangely, it worked. They played better as a team. Same thing for pregame warm-up. We all piled into my car and gossiped on the way to the game. How strange and yet wonderful, I thought, it must be to be a girl. And to apologize when you foul an opponent was never a consideration for me. As a footnote, my daughter still contributes to my continuing education by giving me 4 granddaughters. Now, I want to talk about unlearning. This is an important part of learning. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects picked a different option from polls of contrasting behaviors: lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, and behaved according to this assignment. So an introverted person, for example, would act like an extrovert for an entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they each had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something they had never eaten before and read something they would never have read before. The remarkable find, think about the change that you might expect in this group. The remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, they almost all had kept the weight off. Most continued to learn to lose weight. And the team, the researchers were baffled. The weight loss impact was not something they expected or something they even focused on. Well, here was the rationale. Requiring people to change routine behavior makes them actually think about decisions rather than habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. This is story busting in an indirect way to create awareness of choice architecture. In having to process decisions actively, they exercised their choice and decision-making abilities and extended to other choices, such as what to eat and what not to eat. Once you become aware you're actively making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. For example, many came to ask with each bite, "Is this bite in my best interest?" They each became aware that they were writing their own story, that whatever they thought, felt, and experienced, they created each moment. It wasn't just a default mode. The brain changes when we learn something new. Each step of learning must involve, at the same time, an unlearning. We don't talk about that much in coaching, if at all. Why is it so much easier for a child to learn a foreign language? Beginner's mind is the essence of this process because you don't have to forget or unlearn something and replace it with the newly acquired, but simply learn something new. Inevitably, much must be unlearned in order to replace it with the new, like forming a new habit when one already exists. Learning is not the simple acquisition of information, but of a practiced behavior that's introduced with much already existing behavior already in place, and some may specifically be in contrast to the new learning. Doing a slightly different forehand, a slightly different stance in tennis, is not as easy as seeing it instructed and adopting the moves. The old ways of doing things that are already grooved in the brain, an ingrained attachment pattern played out in a business relationship, are already there. A habit simply means you have, by repetition, rewired your brain to make a particular behavior or thought pattern automatic with specific cues. This is the habit. Once a habit's in place, it's an anatomical reality in your brain with corresponding neuronal pathways and networks that execute the habit. Simply presenting an alternative or a better pattern doesn't overwrite the program that's already in your brain. Change can occur, but it's a process of doing a new behavior and undoing the one that it replaces. These are the neural substrates of learning of skills, whether physical or cognitive. So a habit engages software created for a past experience. If it's useful, it can tremendously expedite a default and effortless execution. If it's no longer useful and outdated, a new behavior pattern needs to be created. So a simple strategy then becomes not to fight old habits, but simply start new ones. All the associations of the past habit are then instantly replaced by an immersion in the current new experience. So the ability to unlearn includes strategically not engaging a default neural connection, or to quickly engage it if it automatically recurs. A new behavior needs to be side by side with the unlearning so you can gradually phase out the old behavior and neural wiring. Being aware is always the first step to recognize authorship and own the story created. So here are three simple steps of changing a habit. Self-directed neuroplasticity, in other words, ways that you engage to change your brain. Three unlearning steps are involved. One, relabel the old content or practice or negative self-talk as an error message from the brain. It's there. It's an anatomical reality, so it's there, but it's an error message. It doesn't apply now. Reframe it as a false brain message and not a directive for action. And third, refocus to a desired or productive activity or process. So when we unlearn connections and associations, we weaken the chemical connections between neurons, which is also neuroplasticity, just in the opposite direction. This unlearning is necessary in our neural networks to create room for new connections. The combination of strengthening some connections, learning, while weakening others, unlearning, keeps our neural networks from overload. Now, I'm going to preempt our discussion without your permission, because I'm going to keep you on mute. The last 2-3 minutes, there's something I want to be sure to include. So jot down any questions, and we'll have our discussion at the beginning of next seminar, because I want to be sure and include this. One is a conclusion to what we discussed, to keep in mind that two things. Some problems are better avoided than solved, some things you just have to let go of. Some problems you can't solve, you just have to outlive. And that's from Jung, the psychoanalyst. So I want to talk now in the last couple of minutes about the output channel. If you were to take a test on a paper 8 pages in length, which of these methods would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row, trying to memorize them, or reading the 8 pages 1 time, putting down the paper, and writing a 1-page summary. Research shows the second strategy of putting knowledge into action results in 50% greater success. When an output channel is mobilized in the brain, it creates new neuronal networks and pathways to begin rewiring with the new information to complete the brain cycle. It's so much different than just passively receiving. When you put it in an output channel, you complete the cycle, you complete the circuit. Repeated findings by various investigators show that this type of targeted effort involving active reconstruction of what's learned in some way increases learning on average tenfold over simple passive learning. In one study, when physician's assistants requested that the patient write the date and time of the appointment themselves, rather than the assistant doing it, it lessened the no-show rate by 18%. Think about that when you schedule a sample session with your client. Routine practice includes mental rehearsal. Performers like Michael Phelps, an American aerialist, Emily Cook, write scripts of how a perfect performance looks and feels. Cook told the New York Times how she wrote entire scripts of what a perfect jump would look and feel like, and how she would replay the script into a recorder and play the recorder with her eyes closed. These levels of deliberate practice include mental and physical combinations of execution. All performance expertise involves deliberate practice consistently developed through the output channel. There are no purely motor skills or purely cognitive skills. It's an intricate synthesis of learning and expression. Canadian researchers at the University of Waterloo have shown that people learn better by expressing what they're learning. By speaking or singing or dancing out loud improves long-term memory. Reading and vocalization combine two parts of the brain and strengthen memory by expression through an output channel. There's up to a 40% improvement in learning just by reading out loud rather than silently. So no matter how much we acquire information, study, and learn, it's by putting it into action, the output channel, that we enhance effectiveness and create a performance memory. Putting something in an output channel brings together both sides of the brain, emotional and cognitive, that allows greater synthesis and connectedness with expression. This process facilitates both attention and retention. It makes it your complete story. Thank you, and remember, we'll begin with questions and discussion of what we didn't get to because I squeezed the strike zone here and took up all the time with what I wanted to be sure and include. I hope you guys have a great rest of the week. Thank you for joining me on Veterans Day, and we'll pick up next Monday before Thanksgiving week, so I hope you can join me then. Thanks very, very much.